Hello and welcome to the Data Journalism Podcast. My name is Simon Rogers. I'm a data journalist, speaker and teacher and data editor at Google.
And I am Alberto Cairo. I'm a professor of visualization at the University of Miami, an infographics designer and journalist, and also a book author.
We love using data to tell stories, and the music you can hear is a sound of data made with Two-Tone, an app that turns numbers into tunes.
And this is the Data Journalism Podcast, the only podcast, as far as we know, and at least so far, that dissects the latest trends in data journalism around the world. In each episode, we will explore the latest in data journalism, and we will chat with some of the world's top data journalists. You will get to find out how they do what they do.
So subscribe at datajournalismpodcast.com to see how data is changing the world of journalism forever. Alberto.
Hey.
Hey, tell us about our guest this week.
Oh, yeah. Well, this week we have Jen Christensen. She is the art director, graphics director at Scientific American Magazine, and she has a new book out titled Building Science Graphics, an illustrated guide to communicating science through diagrams and visualizations. And full disclosure, although I will say this again during the conversation, I was the editor for this book, and it was an absolute pleasure.
She is great. And it was so interesting to talk to somebody who has to navigate those differences between digital and paper, for a major magazine. And also just I love the style of the graphics they use. And it was so interesting to hear her talking about how to work with designers and the pitfalls and things that can go right and where she sees the field going.
Yeah. And we didn't get into a lot of details during the conversation about the contents of the book, but something that really impressed me when I was editing it is, I mean, the amount of examples that you can see. The book is extremely practical. It's also theoretical. Mm. So it covers sort of like the basis of, you know, the theory of perception, theory of communication, color theory, etc. But then the book illustrates all this with tons and tons and tons of examples, tons of makeovers. So she takes a graphic that is a little bit dubious, not that well designed, and then she transforms it into something much better. So it's extremely, extremely practical. I'm super excited about this conversation.
Okay, let's dive in.
I'm Jen Christensen. I'm a senior graphics editor at Scientific American Magazine. I got there by way of a science illustration program in graduate school that led me to an internship at the magazine back in the mid to late 90s. Worked at Scientific American for a while, moved on to National Geographic. I was a freelance science communicator for a while, and now I've been back at Scientific American since 2007.
Hello, Jen. Thank you for being with us here today. I heard that you have a new book out.
Maybe yes.
We should start by talking about it, right?
Sounds good to me.
You sound like you just heard about this, Alberto.
Yeah. Full disclosure before we dive into it, because it's important. I have a financial interest in the book because I was the editor of the book working with Jen. It's a small financial interest. You don't make a lot of money out of books. But it's important to disclose that upfront. But yeah, I heard about it at some point.
You may have read it a few times too.
Maybe three or four already, but yeah. So can you talk a little bit about the book?
Sure. So the book is Building Science Graphics, an illustrated guide to communicating science through diagrams and visualizations. And it was prompted actually pretty directly by you, Alberto, sending me an email, I believe, after talking with Tamara Munzner, who's the other series editor, to see if I'd ever thought about writing a book. And I had, but it always just seemed like a Herculean task. And I wasn't really sure about the first steps in going about doing it. Your email sort of opened that door and made me think maybe this is the right time to go ahead and do it. So I jumped in.
Was it such a hard task as you describe at the end, the process of writing it?
Not really. It just took a lot of discipline. But mostly, I used it as an excuse to get around to doing a lot of the reading and thinking that I had been sort of dabbling with over the years, but never, you know, really kind of sitting down and reading very intensely about a very specific section of kind of information design or science communication or accessibility measures. You know, so different themes. I would kind of take a week or two and just really jump in and kind of immerse myself in that topic entirely and think through it more deeply. And I had never really granted myself permission to do that in the past, just because it was always kind of pushed to the edges of, you know, I have a full-time gig. And so I would read papers as they came across my desk, but I never really kind of consciously carved out the time to do it more in depth. Interestingly, the pandemic kind of opened up that time for me because I used to spend a lot of time on trains commuting. And suddenly I had gained a good 15 hours or more a week. And I was suffering from a bit of insomnia. So I also had nighttime hours to dedicate to reading.
The stars aligned.
Yeah, I guess you could call it that.
How do you make the book happen? So I usually tell people, and as you know, I mean, again, I'm trying to persuade a lot of people to write books. It was not only you. Because I think that there are a lot of voices out there who have a lot to say about the craft, and they never thought about writing a book. And writing a book is giving your thoughts and your work the permanence that they don't have at the moment. By being published in magazines or online, they will eventually disappear. And books will disappear too, but they have a much longer shelf life, right? So it's a way not only to share with the world everything that you have learned throughout the years, which I think that the book does really, really well, but it is also a way to give this work a little bit more permanence and also to think about the profession in a deeper way. There's no better way to understand whether you really grasp something deeply than to try to teach it or try to write about it. So this leads to the question. I mean, among the things that you learned through the process of writing the book, which was the one or the ones that surprised you the most? How did the book transform you? What did you learn?
I think some of the self-reflection on my own process was the biggest part, mostly because I really wanted this book to be very practical, especially for people who might not already think of themselves as designers. So kind of stepping back and really thinking through exactly what is it I'm doing at every stage of a project and forcing myself to sort of write that down, even if it feels like, well, of course, I'm doing X, Y, and Z. That's part of the process. It's like, well, don't say, of course, write it down. You do X, Y, and Z. So really kind of breaking things down and examining that process kind of opened up some doors for me to think about how I can improve upon that over time, mostly in terms of things like trying to bring in, do a little bit more kind of co-design with the intended audience. I used to say, well, I can't possibly fit that into my process. I work at a magazine with deadlines that aren't flexible. There's just not time. But when I wrote down every step of the process, I could start to see, oh, there's an opening in this spot, that there's a natural time that somebody else is reviewing it. Why can't I fold in somebody else there as well? So I tried to be pretty honest about that in the book as well, indicating which parts of this puzzle I'm very confident in and I've done a lot and I have a lot of experience in, and which spots that I'm trying to learn myself and grow myself. But I think that may be different. Different ways of thinking about it and different processes could fit into this existing kind of structure.
So let's take a step back for a second. Talk through a little bit about the way that your work happens now. I think, you know, when I look at the work you do, it's pretty classic. You know, it's the sort of work I loved growing up with. You know, I was obsessed with kind of Dawn Kinsley books and how things work when I was a kid. And seeing your work now in a modern context is really interesting to me, because we're so used to just talking about digital and to forget that there are still lots of people reading magazines and how graphics work for magazines. But talk a little bit through that and how your day works at the moment.
Sure. And I realized I also didn't really explain that I art direct and produce data visualizations and illustrated explanatory diagrams. I tend to live and work within the static realm, whether that be in print or online. Everything we do in print eventually goes online. Sometimes it goes online first and is reformatted for different scenarios. But I don't, although I kind of sometimes dabble in interactives, especially in collaboration with other designers, that's not where I live the most. That's not where I work for most of the time. My general process is, I tend to work on features. My colleague Amanda Montanez works on the news pieces, which are faster turnaround features. We usually have, maybe about 4 weeks. We have a manuscript that kicks things off. So the text has already been drafted. So I'm reading through that text, reacting to it, trying to figure out what could be better described or kind of augmented with a graphic of some sort. Working with a text colleague to kind of make sure that our intentions are aligned and that they agree that, yes, this section could be really could benefit from an image. So there's some back and forth there. I hire probably about 75% of the time, I hire a freelance artist or data designer to work on the piece. So then I'm acting as a liaison between them and my text editing colleagues, our fact checkers, our scientists, consultants, and experts to do kind of accuracy checks and whatnot. But it's generally kind of this three-step process once I get a freelance designer involved, where we do a concept sketch, tight sketch, final art. That keeps things from spiraling out too far and kind of keeps us on track and on schedule.
And do you think that process has changed? Because I feel like when I was at The Guardian, we were doing stuff in print mostly at first, and that process sounds pretty similar to the one that we would have gone through there. Do you think that's changed much, or has really things just shifted irrevocably? I could say that twice, irrevocably, in this big shift to digital that happened?
It hasn't changed a whole lot in my experience, because I started out in the late 90s, where the web was starting to be a role, but we weren't doing graphics specifically for it. What I'm noticing when we do digital first pieces, or when we do interactives, it just, for especially the digital first ones, it condenses that deadline schedule quite a bit. So that happens much more quickly. Sometimes we forego a concept sketch. We move straight to tight sketch because you're also often rendering things with code already, or you're not necessarily using pencil for a proper concept sketch. You might be doing some exploratory doodles to help kind of frame your thoughts. But by the time you're getting other people involved to sort of critique the piece, it's often more fully developed. And it still needs to go through all of those collaborators, right? It needs to go through your text editing colleagues, a fact checker, an expert to make sure that things are accurate. So it's just kind of, I think, depends on the time scale. Or it shifts the deadline cycle a bit.
Yeah, I have a follow-up question regarding all these. So regarding particularly your collaboration with freelancers, can you talk a little bit about the freelancers you have collaborated with, and also perhaps briefly summarize the advice that you give in the book itself about working with freelancers? What are the most common types of mistakes that organizations make, for example, when working with freelancers, and what can organizations do to do better when hiring external talent?
Oh, yeah. So I love working with other artists and designers because they very often do a better job of it than I can. So it's sort of like opening a gift at the end of a project. Often I'll come up with a concept sketch, though, just so I can kind of better communicate with everyone and make sure that an artist doesn't get set on the wrong path from the start, especially if the deadline cycle is narrow. But I think when collaborating with designers, and I need to remind myself of this quite often too, and it was really good to interview a few people for this book to kind of reiterate this, particularly Angela Morelli from Info Design Lab, who really excels at collaboration. But just remembering that everybody that comes to the table brings specific skills and background to the table, and letting each person kind of really lean on those skills and to the best of their ability without kind of getting micromanaged too much. I tend to start to pre-visualize things a bit too much sometimes, and I need to remember to back off a little bit and set up the freelancer with the, you know, here's the challenge, here's the goal of the graphic. I always kind of define this goal of the graphic so that we can all kind of have this touchstone that we keep coming back to. And that goal can guide the design. And then I need to let the designer kind of do their work on that. And then when it comes to critiques, just holding it up against that goal. What was the goal of the graphic? Does this, even if it's solved in a way that I wouldn't necessarily solve it myself, does it meet that goal? And that also really is useful to help focus comments and critiques from people like my text editing colleagues and our scientists, consultants, who may start to react to things like a color palette that they may or may not vibe with. You know, it's like, no, let's focus on what was the goal of this graphic, and is this graphic meeting that goal, and kind of focus the comments on that.
I think there should be a course that is taught on how to work with designers, because it's something that's almost like an afterthought for a lot of people. I think when they think, yeah, we'll just get a graphic done and it'll be easy. But what are the pitfalls that you see people falling into when working with designers? And yeah, how often does that result in having to construct the whole thing, or is there always a rescue in mind?
I think one of the biggest pitfalls is not paying proper attention at the earliest stages. Those concept sketches should really be analyzed, as much as possible before the project progresses. Because, you know, at that concept sketch stage, there's you haven't invested too much time or money, and it's easier to kind of shift tax then. If you let a project continue too far because you think, oh, well, this is just a pencil sketch, or this is clearly just kind of wireframed out, it's not very done, I'll look more carefully at the next round. It's like, no, squelch that instinct. Look very carefully now, because I think the most successful graphics are ones that really, like, their composition and everything is very much hinged on that initial goal statement. And if something needs to change, like kind of figuring out how to make the composition work at that earlier stage is much better than letting it go and then trying to kind of cut things apart and paste them back together to make it right later in the process.
A little bit earlier in the conversation, you mentioned your background as a scientific illustrator and the fact that nowadays you produce both visual explanations that are very heavy on the illustration side, but also data visualizations. Can you talk a little bit about your sort of like the transformation of your work, how you transitioned, how you learned data visualization, how data visualization and traditional explanation graphics are similar to each other or different to each other? You touch upon a little bit of that in the book.
Sure. Well, now I see this continuum, and I've used this as a way to talk about information graphics before, but, you know, data visualizations on one end that are fairly more kind of abstract and are rooted in like objects and shapes placed on a page relative to one another. So that's kind of the most abstract. At the other end of that spectrum would be figurative pieces like specimen drawings and scenes. Those tend to be maybe realistically rendered. And then in between, there's this illustrated explanatory diagram kind of section that starts to abstract things. Like, you start to have like arrows in the sky that indicate the motion of of wind and color in those arrows that indicate temperature. So things that don't actually exist there, but are sort of folded into this more realistic world. In college, I studied geology and studio art. And in geology, we were doing all of those things. We were, you know, using Excel to produce really rudimentary charts about grain size and whatnot. And we were drawing cross sections of how different layers of soil might look if you cut into a section. And so I never really thought of these things as being terribly separate. They were just kind of ways of showing information that didn't use words. And then as I went into graduate school to do scientific illustration, most of my colleagues or part of my cohort at that time were a little bit more focused on specimen drawings and botanical illustration and some of more kind of classic approaches. But I was always interested in how do I draw a process or a concept? So then when I got kind of folded into the world of journalism through the internship, I was working on all kinds of visuals, and that whether that was a chart or if it was a diagram. And so I never really kind of thought of them as being separate. And then I think I was very lucky to enter the field at a time where before it kind of bifurcated. So I could kind of hold on to both of those as long as possible. I guess this is where I do admit that I don't do a lot of coding. But I've gotten to a point in my career where I'm able to hire other people who do. So if I know the solution will exceed my capabilities, I have a pretty good idea of who would be good at that job and work with them directly.
It's interesting that you mentioned this bifurcation of the field, because you and I essentially come from the same tradition. It's like we don't see really a boundary between explaining something through a cutaway illustration and explaining something through a graph or a chart. I mean, obviously the language is different, right? It's more formal and rigorous when you're going to build a chart. There's sort of, you know, the use of encodings. There's sort of like a grammar behind the building of a graph or a data map. But at the end, the design principles are not that dissimilar. So I wonder why this bifurcation of roles has happened, people sort of like hyper-specializing on illustration or hyper-specializing in data visualization has happened, and whether that is beneficial. It might be beneficial, I don't know, maybe because, again, I am a little bit like you, right? I'm an expert on nothing, essentially. It's like I code very little. I do code, but I code very little. I can draw, but I'm not a great artist. I can design, but I'm not a great designer. I can do everything, right? But I'm not specialized on anything. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, so I think it's natural that it's bifurcated a bit because access to data is so much easier now than it used to be. I mean, quite honestly, when I was developing charts in the late 90s, we were often just trying to deconstruct chart, like a bar chart, figure out what the values were, and then rebuild it ourselves. We weren't getting necessarily raw data. And now there's just so much data out there to work with and analyze that I think it would be a little overwhelming for somebody to be able to do that whole suite to the nth degree. And also a lot of people are doing data visualization as a tool for analysis as opposed to communication. So that's also another subspecialty. But one of the reasons I wanted to write this book is I feel as though I've seen the book market really grow in terms of all kinds of books about different aspects of data visualization. And it's been really exciting to be able to, recommend different titles for different people who are looking for, you know, different ways into the field or to how to solve different problems. But that's where I started to see this sort of explanatory diagram and illustrated end of the thing sort of get dropped away. It's like, well, where's the book for people who want to be able to draw their, you know, the molecular diagram for their paper or their presentation? Where are the tools for them or the guides for them to reference? So as I kind of find this, the energy behind the data visualization world right now, energizing to me too, to kind of try to figure out, okay, well, there's these other pieces that are adjacent to that field. Let's remember those and see what lessons we can learn from that and vice versa.
Some sections of the book talk about how to collaborate with scientists. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because obviously you have a lot of experience either consulting scientists as sources or even collaborating with them. What are the main do's and don'ts in collaborating with scientists?
Right. Well, my top do is to tell them what kind of feedback you're looking for. If you're passing along, if you're at a sketch stage and you're looking for somebody to review it for accuracy, let them know that that's what you're looking for. You know, that the style will evolve, the color palette will evolve, all of that will shift, but to focus attention on the things that you would find most useful from them with their point of view. And that would be, you know, accuracy. And if I'm getting something wrong here, can you point me towards some references or describe what would make it right? So it's really just kind of honing in on which each person brings to the table and asking them really specific questions to help get you to the next level. So for our scientists, it would be accuracy. For my colleagues, I might be asking them, is this information make sense? You know, can you move through this graphic in a way that makes sense? Because a scientist might say yes, because they already know what you're trying to show. So they're going to come at it with this already knowing how to connect all of those dots in their own mind. So they might not be reading it quite the same way as a cold reader would.
And what about advice for the other side? What about, for instance, because I know that this will happen, there will be scientists interested in communicating better. Why should they care about design? Or why should they collaborate with a designer? Either learn design themselves or collaborate with a designer. And what type of advice do you have to scientists who want to start sort of like taking the first steps into becoming a good visual designer?
Right. Well, for any scientist to kind of have their work in the lab or in the field be worthwhile, you need to communicate it to someone, right? Whether you're communicating it to your peers or to the broader public or to funders. And there's different ways to communicate things, obviously words. And I think that most training has been focused on making sure people can write. But we don't have a lot of training for everyone in terms of design fundamentals and different languages that you can use that are pictorial to help get your point across and to help people have greater understanding of what it is that you're doing. And you just look at things like Ed Hawking's warming stripes, you know, like over and over again, you just see them sparking conversations. So the power of visuals are pretty strong. They can engage a person and convey information. So to not kind of partake in that communication style seems like a shame if you're not kind of using all of the modes that you have available to you. Yeah, and it's a learned skill. You know, I think a lot of people say, "Well, I can't draw." It's like, well, first of all, design isn't really drawing, and it's a skill like anything else. You know, you learned different ways of writing through classes and practice. Well, you can learn some fundamentals in terms of design that'll help kind of take you on your way to being better and better at it.
So, when you think about your work and always that constant search for improvement in the stuff that we do. I mean, what do you look to? What do you look to and say, wow, I wish I could do that, or I want to do more of that? What excites you about where things are going?
Oh, goodness, there's so much out there, you know? It's just, I am really excited about what I see going on in the data visualization world. That's always been kind of neat to see it heading more and more towards the kind of that humanistic approach. And so just trying to figure out how to take some of those lessons and apply them to things that aren't necessarily data visualization. So, I mean, I just get inspiration from everywhere, right? You just keep your eyes open and see what sparks and grabs your attention. And chances are it's grabbing other people's attention too. So how can you learn from that and apply it?
So is there a new technology or a new approach that you've seen recently that makes you think that's something cool that I'd like to do?
It's so funny because I don't know if you're angling towards like artificial intelligence or anything like that. I don't know. I feel like everybody's talking about that.
I am not angling, but I am interested.
It's interesting. About 5-10 years ago, if you'd asked me that question, I would have said virtual reality. I was pushing in our newsroom to get us to do it. I was like, look, the New York Times just did the cardboard Google glasses. Like, let's get in on this. And then it's sort of like, how many people are really doing that for the broad public? It's huge in, I think, the pharmaceutical and medical world. So definitely great applications. But I don't think we missed a boat on that one. With artificial intelligence, I find it interesting, but also I have some ethical issues with the training of those nets. So I tend not to get super excited about them because I'm thinking about the artist's work that it's based on and the ethical issues there. So I haven't kind of jumped in enthusiastically. I think it's a really interesting tool for exploration. But also when people note that, one of the tells is that often there's like six fingers on a hand or something like that. And I'm thinking, I'm living in a world where with scientific illustration, you can't have six fingers on the hand unless that's what you're showing. You know, if it's so I'm not too concerned about somebody, you know, creating process diagrams with AI that will put me out of a job. On the other hand, it is kind of interesting to see how it might push people to, to use that as a tool to experiment with and then go back and craft their own as a human from beginning to end. We'll see.
Jen, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. We have a few pop quiz questions we're gonna throw at you. If you could keep just one of the tools that you commonly use, what would that be?
Pencil.
Simple and direct. Two or three books of classes that had an impact on you as a professional.
Well, Edward Tufte's, the quantitative, which one? His first two.
Visual Display of Quantitative Information.
You know what? I'm going to talk about a book that I just started reading, The View from Somewhere. I listened to the podcast, and this is kind of really impacting me in terms of thinking about objectivity in journalism. So Lewis Raven Wallace, listened to the podcast, now reading the book. So I think that one's kind of resonating the most with me now.
Very good. Okay,
I am ordering it now before Simon has the next question because I think that is something that I'm going to be interested in. Sorry, Simon, go ahead.
Okay, last one. Pie charts or tree maps?
Tree maps.
Look how quick. That was an instant response, that one.
It's all about what can you reformat for the mobile. Like, I love a good circle, but yeah. If you're dealing with a rectangle, there's a lot more flexibility.
They also feed better on any layout. They don't leave empty spaces around or anything. Mm-hmm. They are easier to compose. Yeah. Jen, thank you so much again. Pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me. It was fun.
Thank you, Jen.